It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Does it ever seem to you like the clothing you buy doesn't last as long as it did back in the day? If so, you are not alone. Maybe you've even thought they don't make them like they used to. If so, you're not wrong. Today, we're buying more clothes than ever in history, and the lifespan of individual garments is shrinking. The fashion industry has seen many changes to how clothes are made over the last couple decades, and our next guest writes that these changes have made clothes objectively worse in many cases, especially when it comes to quality and durability. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed your clothes wearing out more quickly than they used to? Do you have a favorite old sweater, coat, pair of jeans that really has withstood the test of time? Where do you go to find quality clothes that last nowadays? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Amanda Mull is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she writes Material World, a regular column on American consumerism. Amanda, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we dig into the whys here, Amanda, sometimes when we say, you know, things aren't as good as they used to be, there's some nostalgia or golden age thinking there. You write, no, there's really something to this. Are our clothes objectively worse than they used to be?
Yes, for clothing specifically, and also really any textile product that you interact with, whether that be, you know, upholstered furniture or blankets or anything like that. The answer is yes, they are absolutely of lower quality in most cases than an equivalent garment would have been, 30 or 40 years ago. Things have changed a lot since then.
You point toward a pivotal moment in the history of how we make clothing in 2005, the end of this international arrangement on the fibers in clothing and where they come from. Can you tell us a little bit about the multi-fiber arrangement?
Yes, that is a trade agreement that ended in 2005 that was purposely phased out from the time that it was signed in the 1970s. While it was in place, held import controls over how much could be brought into the U.S. As far as textile products go from developing countries, from poorer countries. So it made it sort of onerous to bring those products into the United States and sort of cleared the way both for the American garment industry and for garment industries in countries that are a little bit richer and that have generally better worker and environmental protections. So those products were given preferential treatment, basically, in both imports and in the domestic market. That agreement was phased out by its own structure in 2005, which is where you really see the introduction of a lot of fast fashion into the United States clothing market in particular. You get a lot of imports from countries where labor costs are very, very low, and usually federal governments in those countries are sort of open-minded about what kind of chemicals can be used in textile production, what kind of dyes can be used, what kinds of environmental protections need to be adhered to. So the combination of those things leads to really, really low prices for clothing. It leads to the types of, you know, $9 pants that you can get on Shein or Temu or sometimes on Amazon at this point. And it also leads to products that are made with less skilled labor and made with worse materials, because that has suddenly become possible by opening up these new manufacturing locations to import into the U.S.
Now, let's when it comes to materials, it seems there's one word, plastics, that we need to talk about. Now, we'd had polyester clothing. I was famous in the 70s and things like that. But you write, we start finding plastic in more and more articles of clothing, even where we wouldn't necessarily expect to see it. Talk about the rise of plastic and the impact that's had.
Yes. Like you said, plastics in clothing aren't new, and they definitely aren't new since the end of the multi-fiber arrangement. But their role in clothing and their preponderance in clothing has definitely changed in that period of time. What you see is garments that you would probably as a consumer assume would be made out of a natural fiber of some sort that have sort of growing percentages of plastic in them. And plastic is going to be labeled on your garments as polyurethane, as polyester, as acrylic, as polyamide. There's lots of sort of more technical names for it that all mean plastic, essentially. They're just different types of plastic. So you're going to see that sort of woven into a lot of other garments. Something that you might, you know, assume as a cotton t-shirt might be a cotton poly blend. Something that you might assume as a wool sweater is a wool poly or a wool acrylic blend. So it sort of sneaks into all kinds of textiles in a way that a lot of people don't realize. And then eventually, as prices go down, you just get lots and lots of garments that are fully made out of these textiles.
Talking to Amanda Mull from The Atlantic about the declining quality of the clothing we can buy. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences or your questions. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Our producer, Rochelle, who gave you the call, Amanda, and set up this interview, she had her own clothing nightmare story that made her interested in this topic. She actually said, okay, I'm going to plunk down some extra money from jeans from a reputable company. Higher price, right? Going to mean higher quality? Nope. After less than 6 months of weekly wear, Rochelle says the jeans ripped down the inseam in a non-repairable way. It's happened again with another reputable brand of jeans. So the idea, Amanda, that, okay, if we want to get out of this problem, we'll just go out and buy more expensive stuff. It'll last longer, so I don't keep having to buy more and more. Does that even work anymore?
Not necessarily. What Rochelle experienced is something that I think a lot of people encounter when trying to use price as sort of a guiding principle in figuring out what is good quality and what is not. And that is totally understandable. It's something that a lot of people do because it's very, very hard to figure out as just a casual consumer of clothing if any particular thing that you're looking at is good quality, will stand the test of time. We don't have, as a population, we don't have the technical knowledge necessary to do that. But what you see, even when you look at like very, very high-end designer clothes, what you see is a lot of sort of substandard textiles, a lot of really high plastic content, and, seams that are coming apart, metal hardware that is not attached particularly well, or that is starting to tarnish before it even gets sold. There's all these like little details that sort of can give you a clue about what is going on, but you have to look at every garment really, really closely. And with the amount of clothing that's bought online, sometimes out of convenience, sometimes out of necessity, because there aren't retailers everywhere that carry the types of clothes that people need or the sizes of clothes that people need, you end up having to guess because you can't examine anything that's sold online in person. By its very nature. So it's just really, really difficult to tell. And price is, to the extent that it ever was a good indicator of quality, it really no longer is.
You mentioned earlier lower cost labor in many countries around the world. You point out in your piece a race to the bottom. If I'm a manufacturer or importer who's competing on price point, I guess I'm not going to worry about the skill level of my employees. I want people who can do the work cheap and fast. Is that part of what's affecting the end product?
Yes, absolutely. There's nothing inherently wrong with manufacturing anywhere. If a company wants to hire skilled labor and make sure people are trained well and make sure that people get adequate rest and have adequate working conditions and good machines to use, then you can have good manufacturing anywhere. But companies that are looking to compete on price are looking to keep their numbers generally as low as they possibly can, because that's the only way that you can compete on price in an industry where prices are already sort of like mind-bogglingly low. So you're looking for people that you can extract as much labor from as possible, facilities that will give you the lowest prices as possible, raw materials that cost as little as possible per yard or per pound, depending on what you're using. So you're looking at all of these sort of like price inputs that go into how much a garment costs. And if you're just like pushing them all as low as you possibly can, there's basically no opportunity for that to yield a good high quality garment, no matter where it's made, no matter the best intentions of the people making it. If you're just looking to spend as little as possible on creating that garment, then you're going to get what you pay for.
Amanda Mull is with us from The Atlantic, where she writes Material World, a regular column on American consumerism. She's with us to talk about why the clothes we buy now, in many cases, don't last as long as they used to. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this yourself? Have you observed the decline in the quality of clothing? Where do you buy clothes? Is it online, at the store? Are there brands you trust to have good quality, or are you wondering where to find that kind of quality? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Amanda Mull, staff writer at The Atlantic, about changes to clothes manufacturing over the last couple decades that have made clothing worse, less durable. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring out a caller. Elena is with us in Madison. Elena, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that absolutely I'm noticing that the quality has gone down, even in so-called pure fabrics like cotton. It's made so tissue thin, it's almost like the weave and the fabric is weaker, where I can't get much wear out of a garment for as long, because within a couple of washes or a few wears, it's developing like all kinds of micro holes. I've noticed that there are certain countries of manufacture that this seems to be more prevalent. But, you know, in regard to the question of, you know, how do we resolve this? Where are we looking for quality? I sew casually. And so I was raised to say, well, you know, if you want something quality made, you could make it yourself. But I'm finding that as someone who doesn't professionally sew or isn't a mass distributor, the price of quality fabric that I can go and touch and feel, and I know what the blend is and it's something that I would use, is so prohibitive to me making my own garment.
Wow.
That I can't compete with my own labor with the price of going and buying that fast fashion. And I was wondering if your guest could speak at all to that.
Elena.
And I'll take that comment off here. Oh,
wow, yeah. That's super interesting. Thank you, Elena, for calling. Amanda, what do you have for Elena?
I think she's absolutely correct on all the points she made. Even if you are looking only for garments that are made of cotton, for instance, or other natural fibers, you have to be really, really careful about the source of those natural fibers, because, you know, shrinkflation, as we've seen in lots of like food products and things like that, where the manufacturer sells you something in the same container it's always been in, but it has like a little bit less product, which brings their materials costs down a little bit and like helps their profits. That happens in textiles and garments too, where you get sold, you know, a particular type of cotton fabric, but like maybe the weave isn't as dense. Maybe there isn't as much fiber actually in it. So you get these sort of like thinner, flimsier fabrics. So it isn't just polyester or other types of plastics that that affect the quality of the materials that we're looking at. And then, you know, as she says, it is so difficult to beat the sort of fast fashion machine when it comes to trying to figure out ways around it. Even if you can sew, even if you're quite good and quite skilled in making your own clothing, if you want the really, really high-end fabric, you're buying it in really small quantities. So these companies that are manufacturing all of this clothing overseas, you know, is buying it in enormous bulk. So they really get it down to like very, very inexpensive per yard compared to what we have access to at retail as individuals. So even if it's all your own labor that you're putting into it, it is, if you were like really price conscious and trying to stick to a budget, it is very, very difficult to find a way around this if you want something new. The best way to do it probably is to shop secondhand, whether that's in thrift stores in person or online. But yeah, if you're trying to create like a specific thing, it's usually cheaper just to buy it, which is unfortunate.
Elena, thanks a lot for the call. Jeff joins us now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, well, I can be happy to share my male perspective on this. When it comes to my everyday clothing, I go to Menards and, you know, I wear them out and, you know, get another pair of jeans or whatever. But my fancy clothes, I'll go to an outlet mall and I'll find a bargain. Calvin Klein or Eddie Bauer, I have some shirts that are Izod clothing, 25 years old now. And Eddie Bauer is my favorite brand. But what I wanted to say is you can find a bargain when you're looking for style. If you're looking for, you know, the quality and all that, you really do have to shop around, in my opinion.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Amanda, you mentioned shopping secondhand. Do you have any advice along Jeff's lines for if we are buying new, when we want something quality that we can somehow afford too?
Well, the first thing I would say is that if you have stuff in your closet that's 25 years old that you still like, hold on to it. It is going to be really, really difficult to replace those types of shirts at a reasonable price for the same amount of quality, because things made during that era are just made better, even if they were bought from outlet malls or like a mass brand store or something like that. They are things that were made 25 years ago are almost all better than the equivalent product that you would buy today. And they might have been less expensive even. But yeah, if you are looking to buy something new and looking for really, really good quality, you have to be very, very choosy. And the best way to do this is really to go in person, if at all possible, to hold things in your hand, to feel what the fabric is like, to be able to compare things across brands when you're looking for a particular item. I think the death of shopping malls is greatly exaggerated. Some places are losing them, some places are gaining them. If you can get to a mall, there is a much greater possibility of you walking out with something that you actually wear and like for an extended period of time than if you're just guessing on the internet.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Hope we're not competing at the clearance rack. Molly joins us now in Madison. Molly, hi.
Hi, yeah. I buy the vast majority of my clothes secondhand. And I find that it's a great filter for quality, because things just won't survive to the secondhand stage if they're not of decent make. And of course, that's everything from, Goodwill to your higher end consignment stores.
Now, Molly, I used to do more used clothes shopping. My concern is sometimes, it takes more time, right? You got to really be willing to dig in, shuffle through things to find the thing that's going to fit and still no holes in it. Does that worry you, or do you have a pretty good system?
If there's something I really, really need right now, I'm less likely to find it secondhand, but that's not usually the case. I can usually just kind of keep in mind the things that I'm looking for, and eventually I'll find them.
Molly, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. And Amanda, you mentioned the idea of secondhand shopping. I've heard there are some concerns, though, with sort of a garbage in, garbage out. If people are putting their fast fashion disintegrating clothing, they're donating it. That's what's going to start showing up on shelves. Is there diminishing returns on secondhand shopping, too?
I think there definitely can be, as more and more fast fashion sort of like washes into the secondhand clothing sales streams. You have to be pretty disciplined about looking at labels, looking at fabric compositions, even in secondhand situations. But secondhand in general, you're always in a better position to find something that might actually be good, because you are looking at products that are produced over a whole range of eras from a whole range of brands, much wider than you would be able to find at like a single store that you might go to otherwise that was selling new stuff. So I think that there's vigilance required for secondhand shopping, but I think that often that can actually be good. Like, it sounds like an inconvenience, but I think that it can actually lead to a lot better decision making, because it forces you to slow down and really think about something and really consider your options and consider if you might actually wear that thing. And because, it's harder to return things. There's fewer sizes, fewer colors available of any particular thing. So I think the constraints of secondhand shopping can sometimes be really useful.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Amanda Mull from The Atlantic about the decline in quality in the clothing we buy. Back to your calls. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. A few decades ago, I used to be able to buy very high quality wool pants, also wool shirts, but largely the pants for outdoor use or indoor use. Have people just preferred different materials, or has it been the price? I'm wondering what's going on with wool.
Tom, thanks for the call. Amanda, you wrote a whole piece about sweaters where the decline in wool was part of that. Is Tom right? Are we using less and less wool?
Yes. Wool usage has definitely gone down. And I think that there's a few reasons for that. The first reason is that the wool is just the type of product that there's not like an absolutely endless supply of. When you are an apparel company, even if you're not a fast fashion company, you're probably looking to sell things at a pretty large scale. If you are a modern clothing brand, there's just not an endless supply of wool. So wool tends to be more expensive than its sort of like polyester and acrylic counterparts. And so you're probably going to switch down to like a less expensive fabric that can be, you know, can be bought in pretty much endless quantities that are available on the market right now. So wool is just like more scarce. And also like people have gotten a little bit weird about wool from the consumer angle. People are afraid of it because it has to be dry cleaned or it has to be hand washed or you have to be very careful with it in the washing machine. And people are sort of used to being able to throw everything in and sort of set it and forget it when washing their clothes. And they feel like it's giving them extra chores or extra errands, which I totally get. If you're not in the habit of doing that, it can be a real problem. So a lot of consumers tend to look for things that are just like easy machine washable. So you get a consumer preference away from wool in some situations because of that, which makes buying the sort of more expensive textile to use in these garments less interesting to clothing brands, which overall over time gets you just less wool, period.
Thanks for the call, Tom. And just our last half a minute, Amanda, you know, we could boycott one brand and then buy from another brand that does exactly the same stuff. What would it take to change this downward spiral of clothing?
I think that there are really only two things that affect how these clothing manufacturers and clothing brands act. The first thing is just regulation. We had a preponderance of good quality, well-priced natural fiber clothing in, you know, a couple generations ago because there were regulatory statutes put in place that guaranteed that we would have those things in the United States. And when those laws went away, we stopped having them. So there's a one-to-one correlation on what regulation can do for you if you want good, high-quality things. And then there's also the consumer behavior effects, how these brands act. And you know, as you said, switching from one brand to another that does the exact same thing probably is not necessarily effective, but sort of finding ways to buy less overall to sort of divest from the constant sort of cycle of buying more and staying on trend. And
then we'll leave it there. Thanks to Amanda Mull for The Atlantic, looking at declining quality of clothing in the shops that we buy clothes at. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, the UW Board of Regents voted last week to approve a funding deal from Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. One sticking point in that deal was Republican objections to funding for diversity, equity, and inclusion at the UW system. Those DEI programs faced changes and cuts under the deal. Speaker Voss has said DEI programs at UW represent overt racism and called them cancerous in a statement following the Regents' vote. He's among many Republicans around the country targeting DEI efforts both on college campuses and in workplaces. We're taking a look now at diversity, equity, and inclusion, its history as a concept, and how it gets put into practice at different institutions. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts actually work and look at organizations? Have you participated in some kind of DEI training or initiative, maybe at your workplace? What did you think of it? Was it helpful and informative? Did it change how you think or act at work? Or do you think it was a waste of time? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Erica Foldy is an associate professor of public and nonprofit management in the Wagner School of Public Service at New York University. She researches what promotes and what gets in the way of collaboration in the workplace, including issues of race and racism in organizations. Erica, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you talk about the rise of this concept? I guess three concepts that end up being lumped into one: diversity, equity, and inclusion. Tell us a little bit about the history of these ideas.
Sure. So I think most of us are aware that in the 1960s, there were these landmark bills passed, equal employment opportunity. There was also affirmative action was instituted. And both of those were really about trying to avoid discrimination. And those were in place for, you know, a couple of decades. And around the mid-80s, there was a dawning realization that those initiatives were not enough, that organizations had to go beyond simply avoiding discrimination to actively, you know, proactively welcoming and including individuals from very different backgrounds in their organizations, and also towards being more equitable. So, you know, diversity, that the D in DEI, is about representation of different groups. Equity is about justice in organizations or people being treated equally. And I is about inclusion. Do people feel they belong? Are they included in both task networks and social networks? So these programs have now been in place for, you know, coming on 30 years, and they vary a lot across organizations, but there's been a huge wave of these programs that was then strengthened in the wake of the George Floyd murder in 2020.
I wanted to ask about that variation, because I think sometimes we talk about DEI as a thing, or, you know, as a system or a kind of training. Can you talk about some of the different approaches that we've seen emerge over the years?
Sure. When we think about DEI, we can think about three big buckets of, you know, initiatives or programs. The first bucket is about training, workshops, seminars. I mean, you can call them different things. But, you know, the vast majority of organizations that have DEI programs have some kind of educational opportunities for their employees so they can learn more about stereotypes, implicit bias, multiculturalism, and a variety of other things. So one big bucket is training programs. A second bucket you can think of as structural changes. You can think of them as policy changes. These are formal, written down policies and procedures in the organization that are changed in order to make the workplace more welcoming to people from different backgrounds. So things like HR policies, work-life practices, expanding the number of religious holidays that employees can take advantage of, changing recruitment policies. All those are formal policies, and a lot of organizations make changes in those policies as part of their DEI programs.
Now, a lot of the political backlash is coming, I think, from conservative America these days. But I not that long ago, it seems like more concerns were being raised by people sympathetic to the goals of DEI programs, but saying, yeah, maybe a lot of companies or institutions are implementing programs to say, look, we have a DEI program, just paying lip service rather than tackling deeper issues. Have you seen that as a concern?
Yeah, I would say that the criticism of these programs comes from both the left and the right. And from the left, people are concerned that there's not enough teeth in these programs. They're not hard hitting enough and that they're not comprehensive enough, that they tend to focus more on individual change and not on those policy changes that I was talking about. However, it is the criticism on the right that has really gotten much, much more attention for a variety of reasons that we can talk about.
Talking to Erica Foldy from the Wagner School of Public Service at New York University, looking at DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion programs at universities, workplaces, and more. What they are, how they work, what they do. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Erica, let's talk about that now. The more recent conservative criticisms, attacks on DEI policies. One common argument we've heard here in Wisconsin and elsewhere is, you're treating people differently based on race. You're actually deepening division rather than bridging division. Can you talk about the concerns you've seen and what you see in DEI programs, whether it matches with that critique?
Right. So whenever I hear someone saying that someone else is being divisive, it makes me suspicious. Generally, the people who say that other people are being divisive, I think that's code for, why do we need to change the status quo? So people for whom the status quo is working, you could argue white men in organizations, people for whom the status quo is largely working, they don't need to speak up. They don't need to raise any issues because everything's working for them. It's the people for whom the status quo is not working, say women, people of color, who are speaking up and saying things aren't working for us. They're the ones that are seen as divisive. The people who are holding on to the status quo are being just as divisive. Both sides are are holding on to what they want to see, you know, the policies that they want to see. Speaking up and saying, actually, we think that the workplace could be more welcoming and could be more just and fair, I would argue, is not being divisive, it's being inclusive.
It's Brianna Caller at 800-642-1234. Kate is with us in Madison. Kate, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call, and thank you so much, Dr. Foley, for being here. I caught the beginning of your segment, and I appreciated kind of the historical context that you had offered at the beginning, but that was kind of situated in like the 1960s and 70s. And I was just curious if you could speak to the way that DEI and issues of critical race theory are really going back to, the time of enslavement in the United States' history, and the way that a lot of our systems and structures are kind of inherently racist. And so with that as the context, I think you just kind of said it, there are different ways for different people are coming in at different like, kind of levels. And so I'm just curious if you could also help frame it from the perspective of a larger historical moment in the U.S.
Okay, thanks for the call, Erica.
Yeah, it's a really great question. So when I talk with my students about this, I say, you know, there have been different approaches to, you know, quote unquote, diversity, equity, and inclusion over the centuries. You know, a couple of centuries ago, our approach was enslavement. It was genocide. Those were the ways that how did we deal with differences, you know, in the workplace? That was how we did it. Now, that you're absolutely right that provides the historical backdrop to, you know, what happened later with Jim Crow laws in the South and other kinds of both, you know, explicit and implicit racism and discrimination across the United States. And of course, that is also the historical backdrop to the landmark civil rights legislation that took place in the 1960s. What I do think is really important is that whenever a group makes progress, you know, through the civil rights movement or other means, whenever a group makes progress, there is almost always a backlash against that progress. There are people for whom that progress is threatening. And I think when things have been run for people like you in your image for decades, or as you're pointing out, hundreds of years, it can be very threatening when other people come and say, you know what, this workplace isn't working for me. I think we need to make some changes. So that history of our racism absolutely flows from hundreds of years, since our country was founded. And it still, in some ways, shows up in our workplaces today. And diversity, equity, and inclusion programs are one way to start overcoming that history.
Thanks for the call, Kate. We're talking about DEI practices, diversity, equity, inclusion, what they actually look like in organizations and on college campuses. Erica Foldy is our guest, associate professor of public and nonprofit management in the Wagner School of Public Service at New York University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Do you think a DEI programs at work or school, or maybe your workplace or campus, have been effective or have gone too far? Do you see value in this? Have you been through some kind of a DEI training or program or strategic planning yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk about diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, how those concepts are put into practice in workplaces and higher education, goal setting, training, and more. Erica Foldy stays with us, associate professor of public and nonprofit management in the Wagner School of Public Service at New York University. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Somebody might be wondering, Erica, they're with an organization, they don't have a DEI program in place, or there's maybe something, but they don't really do much with it. How does an organization start to take this journey?
What I recommend to organizations is that they think in terms of three buckets. So we talked about workshops and trainings. We talked about policies that need to be changed. And then organizations also need to think about culture. Our organizational culture is, it's intangible. It's actually very difficult to put your finger on. We often take things for granted, the way meetings are run, the way people dress, what kinds of interactions people have in the workplace. All three of those elements, educating individuals, changing policies, and trying to change organizational culture, all those things should work together in creating organizational change. And if you only do one of those things, like a lot of organizations just do trainings, if you only do one of those things, you're not actually going to make much of a dent in how your organization works and its capacity to be diverse, equitable, and inclusive. So my big advice to organizations is that they try to create a more comprehensive program that includes elements of cultural change, policy change, and individual change through educational programs.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tony is with us in Madison. Tony, hi.
Hi. Yes, it's Tony. I'm a DEI strategist in Madison, and I was questioning, I love this conversation around DEI. My question is around the accountability, transparency process of DEI. I'm very much pro-DEI. I know it's imperfect as a strategy, but I know that fellow consultants and strategists have said it's a wild, wild west out here with a lack of standardization. So can the speaker briefly talk about what is a solution for like standardization, even like transparency processes around even how negotiations and business, when people enter DEI business, what that can look like in an ethical way.
Tony, thanks for the call. A lot there, Erica, a wild west of consultants, Tony says. What do we do about that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I have personally not heard that. You know, I do some consulting. I have a colleague that I do some consulting with. And what we tell organizations is that recipes don't generally work because organizations are so different. They differ by size. They differ by their particular mission, the services they provide, the products that they create. They're in different parts of the country. They may have very different, the demographics of their workforce may be very different. So we generally encourage organizations to find solutions that work for them. And we don't necessarily encourage standardization. I'd be interested in hearing more from the caller about what the concerns are there. But in general, we think that adapting the approach to the organization is going to be much more successful.
Thanks for the call, Tony. That said, how do we measure success? Even if it's, you know, it will be different from one organization to another. He brought up the issue of accountability. How do we know if a DEI program is setting good goals and accomplishing those goals?
Yeah, it's a really great question. So there are a variety of ways you can do that. Certainly, you can look at the representation of different demographic groups at different levels in the organization. So we want to know that people from marginalized groups are, you know, making it up into the C-suite, into the higher level leadership of the organization. And you can certainly track how those numbers look over time. Another thing that organizations can do is to have a yearly or, you know, maybe bi-yearly climate survey where people are asked, you know, how are you feeling about your workplace? How included do you feel? Do you feel you belong? And you can track the results of those surveys. You can also look at who's applying to your organization. What kinds of people from what kinds of backgrounds are attracted to your organization to apply in the first place. Of course, you want to be very equitable in the recruitment process. But one big question for organizations is, who's applying to us? Are we appealing to the kinds of people that we want to appeal to? So there are multiple ways that you can track progress.
Thanks again for that call, Tony, at 800-642-1234. Erica Foldy is with us from the Wagner School of Public Service at New York University, looking at DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, practices, trainings, and more at workplaces, campuses, and other organizations. Let's go back to your calls now. Carolyn is with us in Oregon. Carolyn, hi.
Yes, hi. I'm from Oregon, Wisconsin, south of Madison. I'm 82 years of age at this point. I had been a social worker for several years. I was a clerical worker with University of Wisconsin for over 20 years. And I have to say that I enjoyed the ethnic diversity on campus. And I did have training to understand the effects of racism on people of color, primarily the black population. And I thought that information was very helpful for me. It's helpful for me to understand and see someone else's perspective. But I'm a social worker, so, you know, my goal always is to relate to the client, or now I relate to anyone. And I also like taking in the big picture to understand where someone is coming from with the way they present themselves or whatever.
Caroline, and I gotcha. Thanks a lot for sharing that story. I don't have a lot of time left, but Erica, Caroline, giving some success story there for her DEI training.
Yeah, which is lovely to hear. Training varies. And of course, different kinds of trainings are going to appeal to different kinds of people. But it's certainly possible to develop thoughtful, generous training programs. Training programs that focus on learning and growth, that are not about, punishing people or making people feel like they're bad people. If they say something inappropriate, it's quite possible to develop training programs that really give people the space and the opportunity to reflect and to think and to grow. And it sounds like the caller had an experience like that.
Thanks again for that call. But Erica, I think you just hit on one of the critiques, concerns, fears of DEI programs for white people in particular. I think it's fair to say that they're going to be attacked. They're going to be portrayed as the bad guy in these programs. How do you tackle that concern?
The best way that facilitators of these programs can tackle that is to make it very clear that not only do we all make mistakes and do we all need to grow, but me, the facilitator, I've made mistakes and I needed to grow. So in my teaching, I often give examples of times when I made an error and I apologized and tried to make amends. And I try to make it, I try to normalize the fact that we're all going to make mistakes. And so what we want to do is we want to focus on, you know, telling people that there are other ways to say things or other ways to do things, that we understand that we can change our behavior. And that doesn't mean that we were bad people to begin with.
Time for one more caller. Jerome is with us in Racine. Jerome, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make the quick point that there's all these attacks on DEI lately. And it's useful to consider what the opposite of all three of those are, which is having all of one type of person in a place, inequality or exclusion. And it just makes you wonder if the people against DEI would believe in those type of things instead.
Jerome, thanks for the call. Erica, what do you think of Jerome's way of framing that?
You know, I totally love that. And it makes me think of an example. So, you know, you can't see me on the radio, but I'm very short. And so I have a hard time. Sometimes I'm in the grocery store. I have a hard time, you know, reaching that highest shelf. And I have to ask someone for help and it's embarrassing. So if I go to the store manager and I say, you know, could you please make sure that things are on lower shelves so that I can reach them? You know, is that being divisive? No, that's being inclusive. That's saying that different people have different needs. And being aware of that that's what DEI programs are all about. And that's exactly what the caller is saying.
Erica, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Erica Foldy, Associate Professor of Public and Nonprofit Management in the Wagner School of Public Service at New York University. We talked to her about some of the history of DEI practices, diversity, equity, and inclusion, how they actually look at work and at colleges, and how efforts continue to evolve over the years. Still time for you to share your thoughts via email. You can email ideas@wpr.org with your experiences or questions that we could tackle in a future segment. Again, email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, get advice on having a safe holiday season without catching or spreading respiratory illnesses. Things like COVID, of course, the flu, and RSV. They'll have the top state public health official on the show. You can join in now with your questions. Again, email ideas@WPR.org and then join that conversation. It's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. UW-Madison is in the midst of an anniversary celebration marking 175 years. And when you're a university with your own dairy production facility, there's one clear way to celebrate an anniversary: dairy style. A couple months back, the Babcock Dairy Plant announced the winner of the anniversary ice cream vote competition. The winner was 175 s'more years, described as a, quote, rich chocolate ice cream with a marshmallow swirl and graham cracker crunch. I'm in. That's the ice cream. How about the cheese? Last week, Babcock posted a photo gallery showing the production process and final product for Cradiverse Cherry Cheese. It's a brick-style cheese made with Wisconsin milk, Door County cherries, and Wisconsin Rapids cranberries. Now, I haven't tried the new ice cream or cheese yet, but if WPR wants to send me on a fact-finding trip, I am willing to serve as a journalist. This is Central Time.